You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
5 minutes after 10, thank you so much for staying with us. We have yet another media debate. The last couple of ones we've had have been absolutely fascinating. You remember we started off the series by asking whether owners are killing journalism. Last week we talked about women in media, and this week we asked the question, is our media racist? You can have your say. If you don't want to call in, you can tweet your thoughts, your questions for my guests, or just your viewpoint on the matter by using the hashtag racism in media. So hashtag racism in media. Or also, of course, just tag us on your tweet at Radio 702 at Cape Talk at UCBS. And I've got a couple of guests, two here in the studio, one on the line, Khadija Patel, who is the editor of The Mail and Guardian. Khadija, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope your selfie game is on point there. Next to her is Richard Poplack, who, of course, is with as an author and reporter as well and writes for The Daily Maverick. Beautifully, I might add. Thanks for coming in, Richard.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
And well-known South African investigative journalist, who's now the editor of African Times, is Pete Ramperi. How's it, Pete?
Hi, Eusebius. How are you?
I was hoping to touch you on your studio. Why are you not here?
No, man. I wasn't able to travel. In fact, I was there in Joburg on Monday. I had to travel there to attend to some family things and come back the following day.
Happens,
so I thought I would come back. But what's going to happen is that next week, I'll be coming. We can have a little chat.
Yeah, we'll still have our coffee or our lunch, yeah.
But onto the
order of the of business for the day. I deliberately framed the question in a pithy manner. I'm aware that the question itself can be deconstructed by nerds. I've already had people saying, why are you not being intersectional? What about classism and all sorts of things? What about gay people? We'll get to all of those isms over the weeks, don't worry. But I thought it will be most hygienic to ask the question in its simplest form and let the complexities be unraveled over the course of the hour. So let me start just with some opening statements, as it were, to clear your throat a bit. Pete, I'm going to start with you. If someone asked you the question boldly, is South African media racist, what would you say?
Yes, it is. And that racism is structural and institutional, in line with our past. The only problem is that we are refusing to acknowledge and deal with the problem as it is.
Khadija? At a high level, we'll get to details and qualifications.
I think that we have to understand the media as a product of society. And if we can accept that South African society is still deeply racist in parts, and the media as a product of that society still bears resemblance and is a product as well of those issues. So yes, in parts, the media in South Africa is still racist.
Okay, we've got some overlapping consensus there. Pressure on you.
No, not racist at all. It's a wonderfully inclusive space where everybody feels happy and marvelous. Yeah, I tend to agree with my colleagues. I think there's a structural relationship between how the media, the media industrial complex has been built up. Certainly the mainstream media and sort of the structural racism that exists within our societies. And I think that's a global phenomenon, by the way. I think reducing it to South Africa is almost pat. And I think it's important, as we sort of engage in this debate, to concentrate on the global elements of this phenomenon, because we very are much a part of the global flow. We have a sophisticated media landscape here, and I think that needs to be acknowledged as we go forward.
Well, then let's drill down into what that means, Pitt, and let's play example table tennis here. I mean, we accept between the three of you, and I obviously agree with that, you know, from my work on race, that structural and institutional racism are realities in the countries we haven't dealt with. We run away from it. But when it comes to the media specifically, what are the kinds of examples you have in mind of how structural institutional racism is rife?
Look, to understand these things, Eusebius, I think we need to, put forward a couple of things that need to be taken into consideration. First is the South African context to racism and freedom of expression, because of a difficult past, we still have a culture of racial stereotypes of blacks in society, racist assumptions and prejudices. And expectedly, this also finds expression in our newsrooms. Secondly, we need to draw a line between blatant racism and incitement of racial violence on the other hand, and structural and institutional racism on the other. The former is what the likes of Penny Sparrow, who referred to black people as monkeys, do. And the former, the latter, is what I call subtle and professional racism. And this is what the media does. Thirdly, we need to also ask questions about how media stakeholders respond. And that is your owners, editors, regulatory bodies like your press ombudsman, and professional bodies like SANEF, FXI, your right to know, and so forth. Instead of acknowledging the problem and working towards genuine solutions, they tend to be in denial, apply selective morality, dump principles, and victimize, ridicule, or even isolate those who demand transformation or challenge dominant perspectives.
Okay, what I wanted to say is, and I appreciate your delineation. Firstly, the distinction between explicit racism and non-explicit racism. I think that's par for the course. I think that's spot on. And your third flag in terms of ownership, self-regulation, professional bodies. We're going to get to that as well. I am most interested to get hard examples on the second point that you made. What are examples in the South African media, and I hate the word subtle because I don't think it's very subtle, non-explicit racism? What are clear cases of that?
Okay, I'll give you a couple of cases. One, when the construction cartel, the scandal was exposed by the Competition Commission of the private sector, mainly owned or controlled by whites, basically rigged tenders, stadium construction tenders, in what I would personally refer to as corruption, although they called it collusion. We didn't see the media coming out very tough or strongly against that kind of wrongdoing, which basically affected the public purse and by extension members of the public. And if you compare how the media handled that issue with how, as the media, myself included, especially as investigative journalist, we often go hard on public sector corruption and public sector, you must read black. We often go hard, we'll chase them around, and it's the right thing to do, by the way. Chase them around, follow the money, want to know who these people are, put the faces to the corruption, and want to know how the corruption happened, who conspired, and how the money was used. Basically, we'll even demand that they be taken to court so that they can repay the money and be shamed and end up being blacklisted so they don't work in the public sector anymore. We didn't see that kind of enthusiasm from the media.
Richard, would you agree with that analysis?
Not entirely, but I will say this. I mean, over the course of what we're describing here, right, I assume being the mainstream media, these are commercial entities. Government ad spend, there's been a lot of talk about it, going back to the Mbeki days, you know, where the government would withhold its ad spend in order to teach the press a lesson. Government ad spend is very small. Well, it's not negligible, but it's a small proportion of how much ad spend goes into the sort of stream. The real issue with corporate malfeasance and chasing it down is that you start to run up against your advertisers, right? And this has been one of the structural defaults, if you will, with mainstream media, which you're chasing profit, which means you're chasing advertising. And very often your editorial is going to, you know, smash into those two sort of those two obstacles. And it's always been a danger of the industry.
So you agree with Pete, you're just accounting for it in terms of commercial pressure.
I think it's in commercial pressure, but you know, does it have anything to do with racism? Perhaps it does. I don't know.
Why don't you know?
I feel like I personally have gone after corporate malfeasance as much as I possibly could. To me, it's not an issue. It's not a black and white thing. For many, it very well might be. For some of the media owners and media houses, that might be exactly why they haven't gone after it. I can't speak to their intentions. I could certainly speak to my own. It's a lot tougher, and Pitt will agree with me on this, going after corporate malfeasance than it is government malfeasance.
Where do you sit on this one? The spectrum of views there from Peter and from Richard, Khadija.
So, I mean, what I really think that is important for us to talk about here is that when we often talk about racism in the media, and it's, you know, it's a topic that's been, you know, hot for months and even perhaps years now, what we tend to focus on is journalists and the production of journalism without actually looking at all the infrastructure behind newsrooms. And Richard's point about commercial pressure is very, very real. And actually, what we need to do is to look critically at how commercial interests also dictate editorial agendas. And this is a reality of South African mainstream media. So we have an example, for example, at the Mail and Guardian, where we've got a fantastic arts editor, Mili Bungela. I know you're a huge fan of hers. You're often talking about her work. The Friday section, you know, for me is often a work of art in itself. And we have, you know, we're producing this section with an active, you know, editorial ethos where we're trying to, you know, revolutionize arts journalism in South Africa and trying to put the, you know, the voice of Black arts journalists, you know, at the forefront and actually look at arts in South Africa from a fundamentally Black point of view. And yet we have struggled to be able to support that with commercial support. And at the end of the day, the Mail and Guardian is, you know, it's a business. So for how long can I do that? How long, or how does that become sustainable? So racism is not, racism in the media is not, it's not restricted to just a newsroom, which, you know, there are issues there. But I think that it's in the newsroom where that we are most conscious of those biases. But it is outside of that and looking at, you know, all the infrastructure around a newsroom, everything that underpins journalism in South Africa. And this is why I think that it's important, and I hope that in the coming weeks you could do this, is that you look at the advertising industry, you look at all the, you know, media buying agencies and look at, you know, what are their views and what are the agendas that they are trying to serve as well. You know, Richard mentioned government buying. Right, government buying, you know, withholding their ad spend. And this is, you know, obviously it's public money, so we're obviously going to be on their backs and we can know about that. But what about, you know, what dictates corporate ad spend as well?
Beautifully put. But I want to, before we take Thabo and Sosha and Guve, we also need to take a break. I just want to push the conceptual point, as it were, Richard and Khadija. At the point at which commercial interest makes it hard for Khadija to say to Millie, you've got enough budget, don't worry, go out and go get that photographer so that we can continue having more Sandis on Gubanes artistically on the on the front page of the pullout of the Friday, which I thought was another work of art, by the way. That is corporate racism. So I'm just wondering here, I mean, being the very good progressive media peer of mine that you are, why would you even hesitate, even if it's at the level of saying, I don't know, why would you want to even, as a thinking aloud, want to dabble in drawing a distinction between nefarious commercial pressures and racism?
At the point
at which an advertiser makes it hard for her to continue having the Friday pullout because they don't recognize themselves in the young Black people that Millie are centering in her arts and literature pullout that she has. That is basic racial identity through the lens of corporatism.
Correct. What I was saying was, to Pitt's point, are editors chasing down, or are they not chasing down corporate interests because they're racist? Okay? Perhaps. What you just described is corporate racism. No question. So I think there's a distinction between the two. That the arts section of the Mail and Guardian cannot get the advertising it needs because corporates aren't interested or aren't willing is a tragedy. And it is going to stall transformation of media spaces in this country. That's all there is to it.
Okay. 19 minutes after 10, have your say, hashtag racism in media. Call us on 021-446-0567. You've heard some fascinating and thoughtful statements so far from Pete Rampedi, Richard Poplek and Khadija Patel. How do you see it? You consume media, you listen to us on the airwaves, you read our stuff, you follow us on social media. Is there institutional racism in the media? What does it mean practically for you? And how would you like stories to be told differently to what you are actually seeing? And do you have sympathy for what particularly Richard and Khadija has outlined to you in terms of how complicated the overall value chain of journalism is. And sometimes journalists have a lot of power, but less power than many of you know. 011-883-0702, the lines are open. Okay, let's engage the listeners a little bit. We're talking today about racism in the media, hashtag racism in the media, if you want to put your views there. Then I will also check what it is that you are saying about this topic. And I'm in conversation with Pete Trompetti, with Richard Poplack, and also with Khadija Patel, all of them well-known South African journalists. Pete, here's a question for you on our SMS line. Pete chooses to repeat a wholly inaccurate summary of the construction cartel saga. It was not exposed by the Competition Commission. It was exposed by Jacques Pau in City Press. And that's an important thing to correct. What do you say to that?
Okay, before I come to that question, let me agree with my colleagues, Richard and Khadija, about commercial pressure. But I just want to say it's not entirely about those pressures. I'll give you an example. There was a story in the West End last year or the year before where four white guys appeared in court on allegations of crime. And on the same day, Hope Zinde's son was also appearing in court for allegedly killing his mother. One of the Times Media Group newspapers, I think it was the Times or whatever, they mentioned Hope Zinde fan's name and withheld the names of those four guys. We also saw how the media reported the Oscar Pistorius murder case. Immediately or the following morning after the murder actually took place, most of the mainstream media houses were basically in denial about that crime. Normally, you would have newspapers or the media generally saying Peter and Peggy appears in court for allegedly killing his girlfriend, so-and-so. But with that story, we had headlines, very funny headlines, where most of the headlines said Oscar Pistorius appeared in court in connection with the murder of his girlfriend, not for allegedly murdering that person. So there's clearly those kinds of elements. Recently, we also had another case where a white person appeared in court or was accused of swindling investors of about 200 million rand. One of the newspapers ran the story, published the story, but instead of publishing the face or the picture of that person, they then used a picture of the hand of a black person. Those are the kind of racist attitudes in the media which have got nothing to do with commercial interests, because those people are not necessarily corporate advertisers. But now, coming back to the question raised by one of your callers, I didn't make a point about who necessarily exposed the cartel, but how the media reported the attack, the cartel moving forward. Yes, Jack Paul may or may not have exposed that thing. I'm not aware of that. But check how the media, or he himself, Jack Paul, followed up on that cartel after exposing it. There was really, it was actually the story was published or in passing. It was reported in passing once off and that's it. But compare how that story was covered with how public sector corruption or black corruption is normally covered. The story will be followed all to the latter. The follow-ups will be done across the board. And there's nothing wrong with that. All I'm saying is that as the media, we must not be selective. Where there's corruption, we must cover it and use the same principles.
Okay, so if we just cut through all of that in terms of what the patterns of reporting are, the patterns of framing, the patterns of which victims, even in crime stories, have their bodies become subject of interesting legal and ethical questions about what pictures you put in, what you don't, and which victims are just, quite frankly, anthropologized. Is the media then, overall, for you, Pete, and just give me a snappy answer on this one, filled with a bunch of racists?
Look, the media is filled with a bunch of racists and racist apologists. There are people who are not necessarily racist, but they think they need to play along because challenging those kinds of decisions or ways of doing things, one, becomes career limiting. They think their upward mobility in their newsrooms is going to be short, and also don't want to be isolated, because the media has got this uncanny ability to always isolate, ridicule, victimize people who demand accountability and people who demand fairness.
Okay, let me bring Khadija in here. Khadija, there's a tweet from Aubrey that dovetails in a sort of circuitous way with, I think, what Peter has just said. But which I do not mean not a brilliant tweet, Aubrey, but it's slightly different. But I want to marry Aubrey's tweet with what we've just heard from Pete. Aubrey says, there's racism in the media, but there are no racists in the media. There's corporate racism, but there are no racists. We obviously know that Aubs has got one, his tongue in one side of his cheek there. Isn't the danger when we talk about things like structural racism, institutional racism, not just in the media, in our society in general, that those are lacquer terms to agree on, because we're not talking about the individuals. We're not asking the question, is Khadija a racist editor? Is Eusebius a self-hating black? Is Pitt himself, unbeknownst to him while pretending that he's lit, simply doing journalism through the prism of what white people were thinking is doing? And these are all elements of how racism has affected the content of our work.
So I think there are various ways to answer your question. I think that we cannot, while acknowledging the existence of racism, on a structural level, we cannot also deny that it also exists within individuals. And that's how it's perpetuated, isn't it? It's people themselves who perpetuate this. It doesn't, it's not an environment, it's not a plant, right? So this is really important, that racism is a social construct, and social constructs need people to further them. That's crucial. So when we say that racism is, a social construct, and that, racism in the media is, a product of institutional racism in South Africa, that does not deny the fact that there are people harboring racist attitudes that work in the media. It's certainly, I don't think that, it's either or. Definitely not. But I think that, something that, that Richard pointed out, early on in this discussion, and I think that it's really important for us in South Africa, because we tend to be so insular. And we tend to think that our problems are so unique without actually understanding how global media works and how our own context fits into a whole world. And the fact that we look to the US, for example, and look at the issues that, that they're having over there, also regarding race. Or, there's the obvious, the obvious examples that are obvious, that are often given in these situations, where, a Boko Haram attack in Nigeria that would leave hundreds of people dead. I mean, there were a couple of Boko Haram attacks, within the last few weeks. It doesn't get the same attention. It doesn't get us riled up. It doesn't make our bulletins with the same prominence as it would if this was an attack in France, right? It's because, the whiteness, the hegemony of whiteness in that we're talking about here in South African media is connected to, this Eurocentric nature of the world.
Sure, fair enough. It's half past 10. Rich, I'll give you a chance just on the other side of this.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Okay, this is really, it's an absolutely gorgeous conversation, and everyone's getting along so nicely, even while disagreeing in the details. Beautiful conversation. Our listeners want to engage you guys. I've got millions of calls, but Richard, I did say I'll give you a chance just to react there.
Yeah, I sort of wanted to extend Khadija's point a little bit. One of the interesting things, I mean, Pitt was talking about representation, and there's reams and reams and reams of academic and other data that sort of confirms the fact that black people and white people are not represented equally in our news. I want to talk for just a second about the people who aren't represented at all. Much like the American news system, we have a very sophisticated media landscape, but we have two coasts, effectively. We have Cape Town and we have Johannesburg, and we have this big hole in between. Now, there's lots of media within that space, but because we're so divided, it's our own version of flyover country. All of these things aren't connected. So there's tons of people who, in the mainstream media, the media that actually sets the narrative, who aren't represented at all. And that is a lethal hole, a lethal lacuna in our media space that effectively undermines, a lot of what we say. We don't know how people think. They know how they think. They have their own media, but these connections just aren't made. And it sort of starts unwinding the ligature of the country's mediascape in a very dangerous way.
Okay, let's take a couple of calls. Hello, Noir Bo, good morning to you.
Eusebius. I just wanted to highlight something that comes up regularly, that the bread price fixing scandal didn't get the airplay that I feel that it should have got, because I feel that it was one of, you know, the biggest, the most scandalous corruption stories ever. Because, I mean, all corruption is bad, obviously, but they were literally taking food out of poor people's mouths. And how that fits into your current discussion, maybe you guys can say whether I'm right or wrong, is that it was white corporates and it was white-collar crime, inverted commas, and that's why it didn't get the airplay that it should have got. I still feel that that was, for me, one of the most scandalous things ever, that they sat in a room and colluded about how much bread it's going to cost and they were going to increase the price of bread.
Lonaba, can I ask you a practical question as a reader, as a viewer, as a listener? When you say it could have got more or better coverage, how would you have liked to see the story about that bread fixing scandal told differently?
It was just, well, I mean, I'm very young, so you guys are much older, so you guys would know. But I remember it being a story in passing on all formats. So, you know, newspapers or radio shows. It was around for like a month or 2 months. Let me say, it received much less exposure and was talked about much less than, you know, other corruption scandals. So, yeah.
Okay, no, I don't disagree with you. I'm just very curious, I guess, because sometimes it's so fascinating how the classic examples of stories that are alleged not to be sufficiently covered in the media are in fact part of public memory. And so I think to myself, no, but was it really as bad as you think it is? The same with the cartels when it comes to the construction industry. So I'm trying to get a sense of why people insist those stories are poorly covered, and yet you can name drop those examples without even thinking about them. The same in the present, for example, as we're doing the Gupta email leaks. Names like Bell Pottinger, KPMG, McKinsey, Trillion, they're just rolling off the tongue because the media is covering them. Sibongile, hello.
Hello, Eusebius.
Hey, you made it.
Yes, I did. Thank you. Yes. I just have just a few points on the matter. I think, firstly, I think people have touched on the socialization of journalists, but I also think that on a subliminal level, you have other issues. The fact that, for example, when we see the Cape Flex, they are juxtaposed with images of gangs, that the Khoi and San people are almost invisible in the media, as if they don't even exist. But when you deal with rape stories, well, so I understand, for example, that in South Africa, the biggest population is black. That mainly it's black men that are featured in that. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be featured, you know. But I also think, you know, who makes news? You know, that's another issue. And if you look on, sometimes you look at racism only in overt stuff. But if we do that, you also miss why some black kids who've never heard someone even calling their play word, but who think that black dolls are simply ugly. And I think that, you know, I know that, for example, towards the late 90s, the Women Media Watch at the time did a research on women in the media, and that black women in politics tend to be featured in such a terrible way compared to their counterparts. And so I think that, you know, in South Africa, you also have race that, you know, intertwined with class. And you find that sometimes, I mean, there's a new school of thought that has emerged that says you can be all that you can be. And I think whilst I believe that everyone should be afforded the opportunity to be all that they are, but it doesn't validate the experiences of many black working class and poor people in South Africa, because it's making the norm an exception, a norm, and therefore. So I think in a lot of ways you have a wide range of things, and who do we go to consistently, for instance, to ask for opinions and things like that. And I think
100%.
And it sadly results now to a situation sometimes where people think two wrongs make a right. Mm. Because we're saying, no, but why aren't white people featured in a particular way, then black whatever, when everything, when, you know, like where people want to defend black people by saying two wrongs make a right.
Mm, 100%. 100%. Totally agree. Thank you, Sibongile. Let's go to Polokwane. Ayanda. Hello, Ayanda.
Hi. Hi, Eusebius.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I'm a journalist who's been operating in the media, in mainstream media, for about a decade now. And I've experienced very direct racism in the industry. Like when, for instance, when I was at Times Media at the Herald, we had some white senior journalists who told us that that some of us are not here on merit, but are here based on BEE and affirmative action. And then, you know, there were instances where black journalists would be forbidden to speak in Zulu or Xhosa. Meanwhile, we have journalists speaking the Afrikaans and the English as well. Mm. So the racism is pretty direct, and I've experienced it as a journalist in this country.
How did you react to that experience in the newsroom, Ayanda?
Okay, usually it's very shocking, but how I reacted to it was that I continued doing my work, and most of the stories were front page lead contenders, and I was a business reporter at the time. But what I understood was that given the fact that our black people had been denied a voice in the South African media industry, as a business journalist, I aligned to speaking to black people who had made it and who could provide their views and analysis on some of the major economic issues affecting the area. But you'd find that the white sub-editors and the senior white people in the newsrooms didn't want that, didn't want the business section of that publication becoming too black. And then what happens is that as soon as you try to change things by bringing in more black voices in the paper, what they do is they try to stifle you, number one, by isolating you or by sacking you outright.
Okay, that's interesting. Khaukhelo on Twitter, agreeing with Ayanda, says, Eusebius, I'm also a journalist, and I know that institutional racism exists in our newsrooms. It is very dangerous for setting agendas. Peggy Nomsa Mochoi says, not excluding black journalists, in their attempt to fight racism in journalism, they at times become racist themselves. And Mbazi Mashilowa says, the media is too generic in this discussion, Eusebius. It suggests a meeting of owners, editors, or journalists who meet and plan. It's also a matter of class. I want to get to that question. Let's take a bit of a break and ask whether the pithy question, is the media racist, is a problematic question. Who is the media?
Eusebius is on Twitter, at Eusebius.
Pits, very interesting responses there. Maybe we can tackle Mbazima's one, which I was hoping someone would ask a question or make a comment along those lines. Do you think that it is naughty of us to talk about the media when, A, there's so many different newspapers, radio stations, etc.? And also, I mean, I can't even tell you own 702. I honestly do not have a clue. So I don't meet with people. I come on board and I just start speaking my openly gay, colored, working class, liberal, egalitarian narrative, and off I go. So should we disaggregate the idea of the media, or do you think that there is a ruse for not wanting to talk about patterns?
Look, I've heard that question before. My answer has always been the same, Eusebius. The media industry, all these faults that we're talking about, start from ownership patterns. In the print media industry, for example, you still have the big four owned by more or less the same people, white dominated, and this has been the case since 1990 or even before. Mm. The owners are the ones who, the editors are not elected. Editors are appointed. And then they can always appoint editors with whom they share ideological orientation, with whom they share other commercial interests, or with whom they share outlooks on life. And that cascades down to the newsrooms, because that ideological orientation finds expression in the newsroom. They don't have to call editors every day and say, look here, you cannot do 1, 2, and 3, please do 4, 5, and 6. But editors, when they're appointed, they know what the mandate is.
So do you think it's important for that reason, Pete, to be transparent about who the owners are?
I think it's transparent, because if the editors are able to say, for example, to the public, look, I've been given this brief. My brief is to not tinker with the editorial philosophy of the newspaper. My brief is to not tinker with the staff complement. I must keep it lily white. I must not transform it. It's only fair that they say that, but we hardly get that. And at the same time, you have owners saying, look, there's a wall between me and editorial content. But we know that's not true, because there have been a lot of stories where editors tried to tinker with those kinds of things, either editorial philosophy, content, or even staff complement. Suddenly, you'll get you'll hear stories about performance issues. Eusebius is no longer performing. We think Eusebius is not making money. We think that Eusebius is dumping on the quality of the paper. But the real issue becomes Eusebius trying to transform the newsroom and make it inclusive.
Pete, who owns African Times that you are the editor of?
I own African Times. Obviously, there are other investors, but I'm the majority shareholder.
Who are the investors?
I can't mention them on air, Eusebius, but they own 40%, 20% each. They are business people who originally come from Limpopo, and then they are in the private sector. I think it's only fair for me to allow them to mention their names as and when they want. But they are equity shareholders in African Times.
They don't include the Guptas, do they?
No, they don't. I can definitely tell you that they are not. They are private individuals, business people, who originally come from Limpopo. They are based in Gauteng. They are in the construction sectors, in medical...
I tell you why I'm asking, Pete. I'm not trying to have a gotcha moment. You know, you and I have a good relationship. But it's really to see whether you will role model that transparency. Richard, I mean, where does the Daily Mavericks money come from? Do you guys have funders?
I'm sort of in the same bag as you. I have no idea. Yeah, well, I think it's a mixed bag. It's a privately held company. I have no idea who the private shareholders are. I hope it's not the Guptas. That's a joke, by the way.
But you can never tell anymore.
Yeah, I work for Atul, actually.
Does it matter who the owners are, Khadija?
I think it matters that we are transparent about who they are. I think that's very important. I think that we cannot be demanding transparency from other public institutions while not being transparent about who we are. So, for the record, the owners of the Mail and Guardian are Masitram Ngobe and the MDIF, which is the Media Development Investment Fund.
You've never told me what to write in my columns, for the record. Okay, we've only got 3 minutes left here, guys. I don't know. This one, and I apologize to my listeners. I've got millions of people, and I'm really, really... chuffed at how you are interested in us self-examining as the media. I wasn't sure whether this series of weekly discussions with the media would be a case of navel-gazing or whether you as the public would be interested. But I tell you, this is the third now in the series, and an hour is not enough. So we're going to have part two of this conversation. So we can only begin the next topic on this question of racism in the media. And it's so awkward. I think we're going to need an hour. And I'm going to start with you, Khadija. Then, Richard, you're going to have to play best white because it's a question about black people in the main. And then you can have the last word, Pete. I sometimes think to myself, I wonder whether we as black journalists in particular are doing enough to fight racism. I think of a number, especially black men, who now have senior positions on the political journalism beat in this country. The number of black editors that are in charge of all sorts of really incredible media real estate. And I think to myself, well, what are you doing? Many of you are culpably silent as journalists, like Peter Bruce, for example, are being attacked. Many of us are culpably silent if a guy that doesn't have the same ideological views as you, a Pete Rampedi, finds himself suddenly out of a job. You don't like that chachara coloured guy on 702. So if he gets a bad ruling against him, you're not going to opine about how the regulatory body got it wrong. So we seem to be our own worst nightmare. Black journalists are not powerless. We have agency. We're in charge of sections of newspapers. Many of us are editors of newspaper, but we seem to just enjoy being able to upload the latest selfie of going home to the rural areas and showing off, obviously, the fact that we can afford a good bottle of whiskey with old friends. Khadija?
You know, Rich, you see, it's one of the defining moments, I think, of my career was when a young student at Wits, when I had addressed them and spoken about some of the issues faced by journalists in South Africa, stood up and asked me, but what are you doing right now to help the situation? And for me, that was a crucial moment for me because it made me understand, because here I was standing in front of these young people and telling them, when you get to the newsrooms, this is what I'm telling you, you need to do. This is what you need to stand strong about. And here she was asking me, but what are you doing right now?
Absolutely.
And I think there's something that, and I don't want to preach to my colleagues, but I think there's something that we have to really be aware of, that we're not powerless, that often, yes, we may feel disempowered, but we have to be able to feel like we can make the small 100%. Increments that result in real change.
Richard, I'm going to give you a minute as a best white to white-splain black agency.
Yeah, no. conveniently, I have a 100-point plan that I'm publishing today on Twitter for how black journalists should behave. That's a joke, too. This is a middle-class profession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can. Try to separate race and class as much as we want.
Can't, yeah.
This is a middle-class profession.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher up the ranks you go, the more middle-class you become. And there's nothing wrong with a good bottle of whiskey.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there's a class version of this question. There's a geographical one,
100%.
As you pointed out a little bit later. And the intersection of them is even more potent. Pete, over and above being able to critique the mainstream media, and you know that I share most of your critique, can we also self-examine our own agency as black journalists? Sometimes we shut up when we shouldn't. Some of your colleagues, my colleagues in the industry, have powerful positions and they behave as if they don't have any agency.
Look, you see this. I couldn't have said it better. We as black people who occupy senior positions in the newsrooms are actually our own worst enemies. In the main, it's because of this framework which we have to work within. We don't want to upset the status quo because that will be career limiting. We also need validation. We want to belong. And we also don't want to rattle the cage in case suddenly there are performance issues raised about you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen black editors doing the worst things in the newsrooms against their own compared to white editors. And in the main, it's because there's this desperation to prove that I'm not willing, I'm not here to rattle the cage, I'm not here to upset the status quo. And that has always been a problem. I'll give an example. At SANEF 2 years ago, in one of the council meetings, I raised a question about us editors being complicit by failing to call out the owners when they failed to comply with the BEE Act to sell shares to black investors by 2013. I said, but we always write about other sectors and people who break the law or people who don't comply with the BEE Act, but we are quiet about our own employers doing the same thing. Why is it like that? Tell me, believe you me, the answer from most of my colleagues was that, look, these guys are our employers and we are afraid of losing our jobs. For me, that was the worst thing that I could have ever heard from journalists, because we are known for being champions of social justice. We are known for fighting for the little guy, but we can't fight for ourselves. Mm. And when we've got positions, we behave like a dog which would have been tied to a tree for 100 years, and suddenly it gets set free, but it can't move beyond that tree because it's not used to having power and exercising that power.
Well, talking about power, we'll leave it with that powerful imagery. Pete Rampedi, African Times editor, Richard Popolek, who writes for the Daily Maverick and is a published author, and of course, Khadija Patel from the Mail and Guardian. Thank you so much to all three of you for a very generous and fascinating discussion.